It's called the Not Yet Open Day, but the whole vision of the project related to opening Portincross Castle has actually captured the imagination of many over the past few years. I want to introduce the speakers firstly. We have David Caldwell from the National Museums of Scotland. We have Peter Drummond, our architect, who has been extremely helpful to us in the past number of years. Alistair Glenn, who's the chairman of the Friends of Portincross Castle, and Walter Colan, who is the vice chairman. So first of all, I'd like to invite David Caldwell. Now, David currently lives in Fife, but we'll forgive him for that. He actually comes from Ardrossan originally. And David, interestingly enough, was involved in the excavation of the original castle site up in the hill behind Portincross there. And he found lots of things, and he tells me there's a very interesting paper published on it. And David's going to speak to us just for 10 minutes about the historical context. So can I ask David to come and address you just now? David.
Right. Thank you. So I'm not really the expert from Edinburgh. I'm the local boy who's had an interest in this place since childhood. This is a place that I could cycle to when I was developing my interest in archaeology. And my interest in archaeology took me to the site on the hill up there, where we found evidence for two earlier castles. A wooden one, which was constructed, I think, in the middle of the 12th century, followed by a masonry castle constructed in the late 13th century. And these castles belonged to a family called Ross, who were of Anglo-Norman origin, but like a lot of the other incoming people in this part of the world, became thoroughly native. They mixed in and they developed their own local culture and their own ways. But the problem for the Ross family was that when the wars came, they naturally took the side of their overlords, the Balliols, and supported the English cause. And once the wars were settled, or the Bruce cause was in the ascendancy, Robert Bruce gave the local lands here to a native family called Boyd, and the Boyds held Portincross from 1315 onwards. So the documents say the actual reality may have been something rather different, because the Ross family didn't totally disappear, and there were various comings and goings as the wars went in the 14th century. I think that the Rosses made a reappearance and possibly still held on to some land here, possessions here, perhaps as late as the 1340s. The castle behind us, however, which everybody associates with Portincross and makes this part of Ayrshire so beautiful and so worthy of interest, may only date to the 1370s or the 1360s or thereabouts. The earliest document which appears to be signed here or witnessed here or associated with it is dated to 1371. And these documents relate to the visits here of King Robert II. Now, Robert II spent most of his life probably assuming that he would never actually become King of Scotland. He was a seriously disgruntled member of the awkward squad as far as the Kingdom of Scotland was concerned for most of his career. He was in the unfortunate position of being older than the King, David II, and not being popular with David II as the natural heir to the kingdom. I think, like lots of other people in this part of the world, that by the 14th century, the Stuarts had gone native. They probably adopted lots of local ways, probably Gaelic speaking. And we have this image of them, of Robert II, before he became king and after he became king, living in his favourite residence at Dundonald, just a few miles further down, stopping off here for the odd night on his way over to hunt on the Cumbries or over to his other favourite castle in Rosse. Very much acting in the same way as his in-laws, the other side of the water, the MacDonalds, Lords of the Isles. And we have this image that this part of the world is somehow very different from the hills or the countryside we can see across the water occasionally when the sun comes out. But it wasn't always like that. I think it was only really in the 14th, 15th century that this split was opening up. That as the people the other side of the world were retreating into a more Gaelic Irish way of life, and the Stuarts inherited the Kingdom of Scotland and were adopting more, if you like, English and Scottish ways, that this division opened up. That for a lot of the time, this castle was not on the edge of Ayrshire. It was actually a central place in a firth amongst islands which were united by the sea. And the very fact you got this nice little harbour here, which could have taken quite a substantial medieval seagoing ship, I think is quite significant. That's one way of looking at the history of Port and Cross. There's lots of other types of history. There's the history of it as a fascinating dwelling of a laird, Scottish lairdly family, the Boyds of Port and Cross, who lived in the castle up until the late 17th century. And the castle was actually their house. They actually lived in this tower here, which has been changed and added to over the years, adapted for changing times. And round about it here, there would have been a farmyard and a barn and a byre and other structures, which are actually referred to in the testament of one of the ladies of Port and Cross. There are many other things which make Port and Cross interesting. There's the more traditional history, which talks about the Armada ship, which came and was wrecked off the coast here. And there certainly is evidence for a large ship there, which badly needs more explanation. And the accounts of how some of the Spanish sailors settled down here and mixed with the local population. There's a whole business of how this might have acted as a port for people being taken for burial farther west. These are aspects of history which are difficult to document, but I think are very important for a place like this, build up a total picture. But it's a castle, I think, which in many ways holds together a lot of what's important about this place. It's a very beautiful landmark. It's a very significant castle, I think, as a place which was used by a member of the royal dynasty, by the Stuarts, and played an important part, I think, in local history. It's amazing, it strikes me amazing that it's managed to survive so long. One of the most impressive things about it is the way that the wind and the water over the years has eaten into the stonework, and yet it's still managed to survive. This attempt to do more for it, however, has most certainly not come too soon. And I'm very heartened to see so many people here who take seriously that it's an important thing to preserve this for future generations. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David. Just to remind you that the restoration programme has 21 entrants from across the United Kingdom, and there are only 3 from Scotland, and we're one of them. Now, that's, I think we've been very lucky to have been selected for the Scottish final, and the final 3 from Scotland, and it will give us a real impetus. It's not often I quote the Scotsman coming from the west of Scotland, but I noticed in an article recently it did mention the castle as one of the three of Scotland's most important historic buildings. Now, if anybody believes what they read in the Scotsman, you can. It is, of course, the most important. Of course, there are many other buildings in Scotland at risk, and we're obviously hoping that the restoration programme really lifts the profile of the cause for the restoration of Port and Cross Castle. Our next speaker this afternoon is Peter Drummond. And Peter is an architect with Lorimer. He used to work with Historic Scotland, but I'm told he's okay now. Peter has been enormously helpful to Friends of Portincross Castle, and we do count him as one of our real friends. So Peter's going to talk to us about the architectural features of the castle. Peter. Cheers.
Thanks. Now, I'm a bit of a castle buff, so there's every chance I'll bore you to pants on this one. Portincross is important, very important, for a number of reasons. First of all, it's from one of the most important periods in Scotland's early history, the 13th and 14th century. Secondly, it encapsulates 400 years of different phases of castle development, a broad spectrum of different castle types and styles as they grew up throughout the country. And then thirdly, it's actually, the outcome of that is quite a unique building in its own right for reasons I'll go into as we go through this. The castle itself was built in four principal phases. The first and earliest phase is certainly no later than 1370 and perhaps quite a bit earlier than that. The core of that castle remains here today, but it's a significantly different building from this one. The first castle here was a hall house, a simple two-storey stone-built structure, which forms not the wing behind us, but the main one onto the sea and the harbour, with a carved yellow sandstone doorway, we can see just round there, not the red one, leading directly to one or two halls, certainly a great hall at first floor level, perhaps a lake hall or low hall for the retainers at ground floor level. And that castle would have been surrounded by an array of outbuildings, kitchens, servants' quarters, stables. The whole of this platform on which we stand now would have comprised probably a walled-in area, several hundred feet across with a broad array of these buildings. The only reason that we have this surviving today is it's stone-built. The others would have tended to be clay, mud and timber. Nevertheless, the remains of all these early structures will be sealed below the turf, probably at a depth of about a foot to a foot and a half. Hall castles are they've really been only recognised in the last 10 to 15 years, but before that we did wonder what the early castles were. They're relatively rare in this part of the world, although Dundonald Castle is actually a grander version of one originally. Court use wouldn't be unusual. There'd be no reason to expect special buildings for court use. The court was fairly mobile at that point. And as a stopping off post, it wouldn't have needed the heavier facilities we find at Dundonald or Rothsay. The castle continued like that until the early 15th century, when the wing behind me, bottom two or possibly three floors, was first built. And this was quite a radical move. This was built to accommodate kitchens, and not one kitchen, but two kitchens, one on the ground floor, presumably to serve the lake hall, and one on the first floor to serve the great hall. And you can see the band, the change in the yellow sandstone quoins in the corners, where we moved from that to later phases of work. Now, building a wing in the early 15th century, that isn't unusual, but what they've done here, which is quite a cute trick, is they've actually brought it out on the gable and used the new wing to protect the entrance into the great hall. Nowhere else in Scotland does that arrangement occur. Nearly every other castle of this period in Scotland is L-plan, occasionally Z-plan, believe it or not. At the same time, they did something else a little bit unusual, especially in the west of Scotland. They moved the entrance to first floor level. They built a doorway on the side of this wing, which you can still see today, which would have provided his lordship with direct access to his great hall. No need to share the staircase with the smelly servants or anything horrible like that to walk past the kitchen. No, you could perambulate your way straight up to your roaring fire and plenty of drink. Now, that though clearly wasn't enough for the growing aspirations of the Boyds as a baronial family. And by the end of the 15th century, we see not one, but two more stories added to the entire of this building, possibly in a number of sub-phases. But certainly the red sandstone work that we can see at the top, you'll notice is markedly different numbers of stones, different coins in the edges. And really the castle starts to become much more like a traditional tower house. We see battlements, we see crenellations, we see the corbels sticking out the edges. A fancier version, if you like, of many of the other ones locally, like Law or Wee Cumbrae Castle. By this time, there's still a whole series of outbuildings, but they're becoming much more formal. We've got things like the remains of this stone building here that extends right forward into the garden. We've almost certainly got a stone boundary wall, which starts off, you can just see the remains of it, starts off at the far corner, brings in this whole area, and one would assume the harbour as well. The castle looks markedly different from how many people would expect. Late 15th century castles are invariably harled or rendered, normally in embarrassingly bright colours such as cream or red. Inside the castle are decorated plastered walls, large tapestries, none of your mud floors and other Errol Flynn connotations here. This is by the 15th century, this is the home of one of the richest and most influential people in North Ayrshire, and that is reflected in it. This is very much a lordly residence. Slated roofs, the slates brought in for as far afield as Seal and other places, are testament to the role of sea power in the development of the West Coast and Ayrshire in particular. However, all is not rosy in the future, because by 1660, the castle is abandoned as a lordly residence. There's no place for castles in the new Scotland post-Union of the Crowns. People are happily building themselves new Palladian and classical mansions, moving out as quick as they can shout yesterday's fashion and abandoning them. So after 1660, some fishermen move into the castle and they do the last phase of work. They happily enlarge the windows. They need the great hall fireplaces twice as big as they need. So they put in a rather peculiar whalebone-shaped stone one. They divide the great hall and put an intermediate floor in. They demolish quite a bit of the outbuildings and anything of archaeological interest above ground level. They subdivide the cellar and they put in timber partitions with hooks hanging down, presumably for fishing equipment. My personal favourite, they steal all the lintels from a whole series of the doors and leave us with this huge problem which a structural engineer has to live with to this day. But fate kind of worked funny on them, because in 1739 the roof blew off and they were chucked out. And the castle remained pretty much as we see it now. It did suffer a little from some over-exuberance by 1920s restorers who popped a nice concrete roof on it, a nice concrete roof that's about to fall down. And in the 1980s, a mason who clearly didn't bring his guide dog to work that day and put lintels below window level. But on the whole, what you're looking at is a fairly intact 15th, 16th century castle, and that's quite rare in this part of the country. If you walk around the castle, you'll see a lot of features of interest. I mentioned the main entrance doorway here. Don't look at the rubbishy red sandstone one that's in there. Look at the very worn yellow sandstone surrounds. That's 13th, 14th century masonry. Above it, you'll notice there's a small indented panel. That's where there used to be a highly painted armorial plaque, typical of tower houses of the period, and no doubt pinched. Next to that, of course, we've got the first floor entrance. You can still see the potlog holes, the joist holes in the wall, where the platform used to come up to it. There would have been a timber staircase running up this narrow passageway. That passageway itself used to be 2 foot wider as recently as 1880, but bits fall off with alarming regularity. Just in the corner there, you can make out the fixings for where the inner gate would have been before you even got to the front door. As we walk around that side of the building, you'll still see fragments of harl, rough brownish looking coat on the wall, right in the middle. That's before you get to the stuff that's eroded back almost a foot. Rather impressively unsound. We get to the far gable, the other side from this, and there's a built-up drain at ground floor level. It's got some rather nice flat arch stones over the top. It's someone spent a lot of time and money. Again, it's a first phase feature no later than 1370, probably 1325 to 1350. On that side, the battlements have partially collapsed. You can make out earlier core structures. On that side, the gable is about to collapse. You don't want to be standing there for too long in bad weather. As we come round to the harbour elevation, you'll see the worst of the fishermen's deprivations. You'll see the lovely picture window onto the cellar with its fantastic timber lintels internally, which are sagging 6 inches. Unfortunately, you can't see today at the inside today because there's just too much chance of a large chunk falling off on top of somebody. The concrete roof and the stair behind and the block behind me, that really is about to collapse, certainly within the next 2 to 5 years. The Great Hall roof is in precarious condition and a good hard stair would bring it down, probably caused by the roof garden and small rowan tree growing out the middle of it. It's a shame you can't see the Great Hall because, again, what we've got are a lot of surviving phase one features. We've got 14th century window surrounds, we've got carved stonework, we've got window seats, we've got this bizarre phase three, phase four whale arch fisherman fireplace. But but even then we can still see the earlier late medieval fireplace. As we go up the building, the block behind us held all the lordly apartments. First two floors, kitchens, above that is lordship's room, above that is family room. We can see his window seat, we can see his fireplaces, he's got two. And then of course there's the attic apartments, not a lot left them today, well not that you can see for the rowan trees. A lot of questions remain about this castle. We've got features on this wall such as a slit window that's the same as a 15th century one at Threave. We've got Gordon Ewart and Dr. Caldwell's theory of a bottle window to a closed up dungeon. And when the project goes ahead, one of the first things we'll be doing is a full and proper survey of the scaffold. We'll be dragging in standing building archaeologists from Glasgow University who are already on board, unfortunately couldn't make it today. We're going to go over this with a fine tooth comb. We're going to dig up the floors internally, such as they are, and see what archaeology remains underneath them. And then after that, we're going to spend about 2 years pouring grout into the thing, so it never gets into this abysmal condition again. And the final thing that we'll do as part of that is that we'll be making sure that everyone can get back into the castle again. We'll be making the main staircase safe. We'll be putting in displays and interpretation. We'll be returning the Great Hall to a condition where people can use it again. We'll be putting in lighting, power. We'll be storing the roof so that for the first time in 250 years you can see the castle pretty much as it was intended. We'll try and get something better done out here so that people can understand what the likes of this archaeology is here. They can really appreciate the full extent of buildings that once existed. And we can only really afford to do that through the Heritage Lottery Fund and through BBC Restoration. Raising money to save any castle this historic is a long-term commitment and speaks volumes for the tenacious attitude of Friends of Porting Cross given all they've been through. But Historic Scotland and the Heritage Lottery Fund will be gay reluctant to ignore this building now that it's featured on the BBC. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Peter. You probably got the drift from Peter there that were you to apply for a mortgage for this castle, it's highly likely you would get a refusal. And that's what it's about. It's about trying to raise the money to conclude the restoration or to start the restoration of the castle. It's I suppose in terms of big projects, not a huge amount of money, certainly less than £1 million. But what the Heritage Fund doesn't do is give you money to keep the thing going after it's been restored. And it's just as important for us to raise money so that in years to come we can keep things going, and the target for that is about £100,000 that we have to raise. So that's a big task in front of us. And as Peter said, once you're on a programme like Restoration, it's very likely that community funding bodies will actually pay attention to us, and we're very much looking forward to that if it's the case. I'm delighted now to ask Alistair Glenn to come and speak to you. And he's going to talk to us about the link with ancient Scottish kings. Alistair.
Thanks very much indeed. I'm not a professional historian, so I can be a bit more romantic about what might be happening. And I'll do it as quickly as I can, but it's quite important to know where we are. And my topic was the ancient kings of Scotland and their connection with Porton Cross. Many people here will know that there is a tradition that the ancient kings of Scotland, this was a departure point for the kings for burial in the Rili Godram in Iona, in St. Columb's Hills Island. Now, the evidence, it might seem rather surprising that from here in Ayrshire, that is a real possibility. And I want you to give a very, very brief indication as to why that might be the case. Go back to 600 AD. And no castle here, a castle, as David Caldwell mentioned, on the hill there, but a tremendous amount of traffic out in the ocean. The Kingdom of Dalriada ran on sea power, and there was a trade of vessels trading to France and Spain getting nice wines, etc., bringing them back to the Kingdom of Dalriada. It was a remarkable organisation, jewellery being made, etc. And this Port and Cross was in the fringes of Dalriada. But between 858 and about 1093, the tradition is that kings of Scotland were buried in Iona. Now, how could it be that they would come down to Port and Cross to go all the way back up again to Iona? Bear in mind that there was no roads across to Iona. I mean, the present route to Iona is probably go to Oban, get the steamer across, and you're not, you know, you're to Iona, to Mull, and across to Iona. No roads there, thick woods. Sea was the only route that was possible. Now, I'd just like to read out to you the places where the kings of Scotland died. Many of them were killed in battle, and they were travelling around all over the place. So let me just read you very, very quickly. Forfar, Strathclyde, Forteviot, River Amon, Strathallan, St Fillan's, Forres, Dunotter, Banff, River Amon again, Fettercairn, Strathearn, Glams, Elgin, Dunkeld, and Dunkeld, by the way, that was Macbeth, Stonehaven. And that gets around the period I'm talking about. After that, Kenneth MacAlpine, who was killed in battle, or ambushed down near Alnwick, was actually buried in Dunfermline. But why would they come here? Well, there were good routes, in fact, on the east coast from Perthshire down into Scottish Midlands, and you'll probably be aware, living in close to West Kilbride, if you do, of the road that goes to Dalry and sets off beside Law Castle. Now, on from there to perhaps via Paisley and on to the Scottish Midlands. So it was perfectly possible that this was the best route. There was a route also through Inverness, down through the Great Glen to Fort William Loch Arbour, Loch Linney, and then by sea again. But the sea route was the fast route. Why didn't they go to Dumbarton, a more established location? The reason being that coming down from Dumbarton, as we saw earlier today, a bit dreich, having to row. Sail power wasn't any use really unless the wind was pretty well on your quarter or behind you. Whereas here in Port and Cross, from Port and Cross Harbour, a substantial sized boat could be round the Garrick Heads across there, south end of Bute, and up to Tarbert, went to Tarbert and Loch Fyne very, very quickly, and then overland to West Loch Tarbert, up the sheltered firth up behind Island Jura, and into Mull, and possibly even direct to Iona if the weather was favourable. So it's perfectly possible this was the fastest route. Certainly in winter time, when it would be difficult to cross the Dromochter Pass. So I would like for you to think that it's quite possible that this was the place where a number of these kings went to Iona and has therefore got an importance. The castle wasn't here, but there's a very old road comes from Dalry up, and a branch goes across to the castle which David excavated on the hill there. So in winding up, this is part of the history. There's lots more, but one of the things that I want to say to you is that this there's moments in time when you can be successful. My belief is that this is one of these moments. Things happen which help you. One of the things which has happened, of course, is the impact of the restoration program. It's been really quite important in moving things along for us. And of course, your part, as well as the contributions you've made in all kinds of help and resources and so on, and in cash, your help can be enormous in giving us a vote. If you think we're actually worthy, because I think the other two castles are actually pretty interesting. The other two buildings are pretty interesting. But I wouldn't necessarily say they were more interesting than Port and Cross. So thank you for coming again. That's all I have to say, but the romance is there, and the practicality is here as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Alistair. Well, we're getting lots of information from the principal speakers this afternoon. If I can just say one or two words of thanks to one or two people behind the scenes. To the Secretary of Port and Cross Castle, Anne McLachlan, who's our agent provocateur with the media, and she does all sorts of things in the background, including guardianship certificates and so on. For Audrey Colon, whose unending enthusiasm and energy keeps us all going and running coffee mornings and all sorts of things, and down at the car park in sunny summer afternoons. So thanks very much to Audrey as well. For the whole committee of Friends of Portincross Castle and the many, many nights that they've met, come down in the cold winter nights to make all their plans and to plan the tactics and the strategies and so on. And it's only through that commitment and energy that we've got to where we are today. And most of all, I'd like to thank all those who have actually contributed to the project. Our last speaker this afternoon is Walter Colon, and Walter was born in the United States, but we'll forgive him for that. He's lived in Scotland for some time now. And can I say that there's no truth in the rumour that he wants to take the castle down stone by stone and rebuild it in California? So can I ask Walter to come and talk to us about future plans? Thank you. Okay.
Well, thank you all for arriving here. I know it looked pretty dismal earlier this morning, but it's nice to see the sun break out and somebody's on our side. And yes, there are islands out there. I keep telling this to visitors who constantly come out and say, there's not a thing out there. Peter, you certainly painted a dismal picture of the condition of this place, and I don't think I'll ever go in there again without a hard hat. It is a shame that we're not able to venture inside and, you know, take a good look at it, because this is something we're looking forward to further on down the line. And I'll play the Oracle of Delphi in a few minutes here and go down the line as to what we envision, what our goals are. First of all, it's the transfer of title. This is something that's being worked on as we speak. And I have to say that BNFL has given us a tremendous amount of support and encouragement in looking after the castle and making plans for it and hoping to be able to transfer title hopefully before the end of the year. Details are being formulated now. Then, as far as the castle itself is concerned, what we envision in the long term is to ensure that the castle remains in the public interest. We started in 1998 when it was planned to sell the castle on the open market. And we felt that this was very, very inappropriate, because with a private owner, anything could have happened to the future of this place. And the foreshore, it's very important to visitors here to be able to come out and enjoy the scenery, to enjoy the presence of the castle. It takes you back. I mean, it's something that belongs here. And I've spoken to several generations of visitors who come out here, and they love the place. They absolutely love it. And we look forward to many more generations being able to come out and to enjoy the scenery, enjoy the aura of the castle. And more, what we would like to see is for the castle to be eventually open to the public. This is something that has never occurred historically, and we look forward to the day when it'll be made safe enough for guided and carefully contained tours through the place. One of the most important points is eventually being able to go up to the roof and to be able to see the scenery which surrounds us. I can attest to that. It's absolutely fabulous. And I think that the public deserves to see what's out there. It's awe-inspiring. And I think all of the potential grant givers who have been out here have voiced pretty much the same thing. And one of the things that we look forward to is eventually finances prevailing and permitting that there will be a roof on this place to prolong the life of the castle. Wish to thank you all very, very much for coming out here. I think what it's done, it's displayed the cohesion and the interest that this castle has actually brought to the community. And not only the immediate community, but also the outlying areas. And even for those Scots who come back here and visit and reminisce. So at this point, what I would like to do is turn it back over to you and and let you direct the folks to wherever they would like to go in terms of refreshments. Oren?
Thank you, Walter. Can I ask you to join together and thank the principal speakers this afternoon, David, Peter, Alistair, and Walter.